to welcome everybody in the meeting of today. Hopefully this day will be a fruitful day like the other, the past few days that we have in the inquiry as we started 2018. Honourable members, there is something that I would wish to clarify to the media, to the people of South Africa. We know that South Africans have interest in this committee and its proceedings, especially in the inquiry. I want to advise that we are in this process because we saw mismanagement and misuse of funds in the entity called Eskom. We are still in the dealings of Eskom. We are still in dealing with Eskom. I just want to advise you and the people outside there that Lucky Montana yesterday came to the committee specifically to come and clear his name when he was mentioned by the deputy minister in a media statement. And in him being mentioned there, it was part of the inquiry. And the committee of public enterprises, even before we started with the inquiry, we advised people that if you are mentioned, your name is mentioned in any platform that has to do with the inquiry, please come forward and come and explain yourself. There is a room open for that. So he came on those grounds. He never came to the committee to come and deal with PRASA issues. PRASA issues lie with the Committee of Transport. Yes, he did mention a lot of things that were happening in PRASA. That was part of what he heard over the media. And by the time when all those dealings were happening between him and the deputy minister, they were part of the Department of Transport then. So he did not come here to talk about PRASA. Let us correct that. Please let us correct that. Let us correct the social media in calling us fools, who could not ask relevant questions about PRASA to Lucky Montana. Lucky Montana did not come here to PRASA, and we are not in a state where we are going to deal with PRASA. PRASA is not part of the entities of public enterprises. It falls under the entities of transport. I just wanted to deal with that. I wanted to tell South Africans and to clarify the misinterpretation of what happened yesterday. Thank you very much, honourable members. I hope everybody now is aware what happened yesterday. Thank you. My apologies for that. I'm not expecting anyone to call me this time. The Deputy Minister, I am advised that he is going to take an affirmation. Is that true, Deputy Minister?
That's correct, Chair.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister. We welcome you in this inquiry. We have been looking forward to meet you here in this inquiry. We hope our day will work very well. We will work very well with you because you are our Deputy Minister. Deputy Minister of Public Enterprises, Honorable Ben Martins, I am now going to read the affirmation. In accordance with Section 16 of the Powers and Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislature Act 2004, as a witness to this oversight inquiry, please be informed that by law you are required to answer fully and satisfactorily all the questions lawfully put to you, or to produce any document that you are required to produce in connection with the subject matter of the inquiry. Notwithstanding the fact that the answer or the document could incriminate you or expose you to criminal or civil proceedings or damages. You are, however, protected in that evidence given under affirmation before a House or committee may not be used against you in any court or place outside Parliament, except in criminal proceedings concerning a charge of perjury or a charge relating to the evidence or documents required in these proceedings. Please be aware that in terms of Section 17 of 2 of the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislature Act, a person who willfully furnishes a House or committee with information or makes a statement before it which is false or misleading commits an offence and is liable to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 2 years. You are required to take and affirm that the evidence you are about to give is truthful. Can you do that, Honorable Deputy Minister? Affirm, take the affirmation.
I solemnly affirm that the evidence that I shall give shall be truthful, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister. You'll just put your name and your signature in the document, and it will be taken by the officials. Deputy Minister, you are going to be led by questions if there is no presentation that you think it is necessary for you to do. Do you have a presentation that you need to make before?
Chairperson, there is a statement that I would like to read to the honourable members. A copy of this, in my understanding, was circulated to your good office. So I believe that members of parliament do have a copy of the statement. But I will now ever go through it.
Do we all have the copy of the statement of the Deputy Minister? Thank you very much, honourable members. I will then give over to the Deputy Minister to read or to summarize in whatever way that you want. We've got the whole morning with you. You can read line by line. You can summarize. It's up to you. Thank you very much.
Chair, for the sake of clarity, so that I don't leave out anything, I would prefer if I could kindly read the entire document.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister. You can do that.
I thank you. Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprises, Evidence Leader, Advocate Vanara, Advocate Libala, Senior Counsel accompanying me, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Honorable Chairperson, I thank you for the guidance that you have provided in your invitation letter of the 26th January 2018, namely to appear at this inquiry in my capacity as the Deputy Minister of Public Enterprises to address the allegation made by Ms. S. Daniels. In your letter, you further brought it to my attention that Mr. Lucky Montana will address the Portfolio Committee inquiry on the 30th of January 2018, and that there was a possibility that he may implicate me in his testimony. Ministers and deputy ministers have a duty to uphold the oath or solemn affirmation made on their appointment as set out in Schedule 2 of the Constitution. I solemnly affirmed that I will be faithful to the Republic of South Africa and will obey, respect, and uphold the Constitution and all other laws of the Republic. I undertook to hold my office as Deputy Minister with honor and dignity and to be a true and faithful counselor, not to divulge directly or indirectly any secret matter entrusted to me, and to perform the functions of my office conscientiously and to the best of my ability. In this time, I've served as Deputy Minister of Public Enterprises from the 1st November 2011 until the 11th June 2012, as the Minister of Transport from 11th June 2012 until the 9th June 2013, as the Minister of Energy from the 9th June 2013 until 20th May 2014, and as Deputy Minister of Public Enterprises again as of the 31st March 2017 to date. I have had the occasion to meet different stakeholders of different departments, mainly in my office, but at other times also at my official residence. In all the meetings that I've had with departmental and state-owned enterprises, officials and stakeholders during my tenure as a minister at the departments of Transport, Energy, and Deputy Minister at the Department of Public Enterprises, there was never, ever criminal intent on my part to abuse the status of my office for personal gain, nor did I ever instruct or coerce any official or functionary to act illegally or to carry out corrupt acts of any stakeholder and or interest group and or entity. No business, company, family or individual, including members of my family, have received a tender, contract or money as a result of a corrupt relationship with me. Anyone who alleges or insinuates that I have been party to a corrupt act or to the commission of a crime, or that I acted contrary to the solemn affirmation I made, has a moral and civil duty to lay a criminal charge against me and to prove it. Section 85 of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa 1996 entrusts the President with executive authority, which is exercised together with cabinet members for A, implementing national legislation except where the Constitution or an Act of Parliament provides otherwise. B, developing and implementing national policy. C, coordinating the functions of the state departments and administration. D, preparing and initiating legislation. And E, performing any other executive functions provided for in the Constitution and national legislation. Ministers, in accordance with the Constitution, are appointed in terms of Section 91(2), read with Section 91(3), B and C of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa 1996. Section 92 of the Constitution dealing with accountability and responsibilities provides for accountability collectively and individually for the exercise of powers and their performance. Having been a minister in two portfolios, I know how important it is to appreciate the functions and authority of ministers and deputy ministers. Section 93 of the Constitution grants the President the prerogative to appoint deputy ministers. Deputy ministers are appointed in terms of Section 93(1)(a) of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, 1996. Section 93 of the Constitution states that deputy ministers are accountable to Parliament for the exercise of their power and the performance of their functions. Section 96 of the Constitution provides for the conduct of cabinet members and deputy ministers. In line with my affirmation, I have never undertaken any other paid work, including acting inconsistently with my office or exposing myself to any situation involving the risk of a conflict between my official responsibilities and private interests. The Public Finance Management Act only refers to ministers as the executive authority and does not refer to deputy ministers as such. Executive functions are thus the purview of ministers. In line with the PFMA, the department has a director general who is the accounting officer that assumes administrative and operational responsibilities on behalf of the department. But although deputy ministers are not members of cabinet, they are bound by its decisions and must support the implementation of cabinet decisions. The Minister of Public Enterprises, Ms. Lynn Brown, has delegated oversight of the following state-owned enterprises to me: Alexco, Denel, and Safcon. The Minister of Public Enterprises, however, still retains the executive authority of these state-owned enterprises. The delegation to me is thus for administrative purposes. Such administrative functions include, amongst others, attending meetings of the said state-owned enterprises, checking the financial and operational reports on performance of the state-owned enterprises and oversight of the projects of these state-owned enterprises undertake. Members of Cabinet jointly and severally have the responsibility to ensure that their functions are executed effectively and efficiently with the view of bringing about a better life for South Africans in line with the National Development Plan. The National Development Plan enjoins South Africa to build a professional public service that serves government but is sufficiently autonomous to be insulated from political patronage. The provisions of Section 195 of the Constitution echoes basic values and principles governing public administration. In essence, public administration must be governed by democratic values and principles enshrined in the Constitution, including but not limited to a high standard of professional ethics being promoted and maintained. On the 8th November 2017, Ms. S. Daniels, in a testimony to the inquiry, alleged that I was at a meeting attended by her, Mr. A.J. Gupta, Mr. Duduzani Zuma, and Mr. Salim Essa on the 29th July 2017. The official Department of Public Enterprises Deputy Minister's diary reveals that on the 29th July 2017, I had attended the funeral service of Mr. Ronnie Mamwepa at 7 a.m. at St. Albans Cathedral in Pretoria. I attended the funeral service, and at approximately 1:30 p.m., I departed from St. Albans Cathedral and was driven to St. George's Hotel in Irene by a member of the South African Police Services VIP Protection Unit to attend the African National Congress National Executive Committee Lekgotla, which was scheduled to commence at 2 p.m. Upon my arrival at St. George's Hotel, in the company of the two South African Police Services VIP protection members, I registered to participate in the Lekgotla and was issued with a Deputy Minister's accreditation card. After registering, I attended the Economic Transformation Commission, which was chaired by Mr. Enoch Godongwana. Ministers Rob Davies, Ibrahim Patel, and Lindiwe Zulu, amongst other members of the ANC, made presentations at the commission. Throughout the duration of the commission, from approximately 2:30 p.m. until approximately 7:30 p.m., I sat next to the chairperson of the ANC Parliamentary Caucus, Mr. Seiso Mohai. When the Economic Transformation Commission deliberations ended for the day, I proceeded to the St. George's Hotel Conference Center dining hall, where I joined the dining table of Mr. Paul Langa, Mr. Vusi Mkize, and other members of the ANC Logistics and Security Unit. I departed from the dining hall at approximately 8:30 p.m. and was driven to the official residence allocated to me in Pretoria to retire for the night. The journey was undertaken in the company of the two South African Police Services VIP security officers assigned to work with me. The chairperson of the ANC Parliamentary Caucus, Mr. Seiso Mohai, and Mr. Paul Langa, and other members with whom I interacted during the commission and dinner are prepared to attest to the foregoing. I would now like to turn to some interactions that I've had with members of the Gupta family. During 2011, when I was the Deputy Minister of Public Enterprises, I had interaction with the Gupta brothers at the SABC TNA business breakfast arranged by the Department of Public Enterprises. There were no business-related discussions. Another time I met the Gupta brothers was shortly after my appointment as Minister of Transport. I met them at an Indian food fair they had organized at one of their homes in Saxonwold. Some ministers and members of the public were in attendance. There were no business-related discussions. During these interactions, I never abdicated my duties and responsibilities as a minister and deputy minister. I should now like to turn to a meeting I arranged between Mr. Tony Gupta and Mr. Lucky Montana. Mr. Montana arrived at the meeting, which was held at my residence. The issue of PRASA's board was discussed between myself and Mr. Montana before the arrival of Mr. Tony Gupta and Mr. Duduzani Zuma. At the time, there was talk and rumors that Mr. Buthelezi and Mr. Montana were going to be removed as the chairperson and CEO of PRASA, respectively. I assured Mr. Montana that I would not support his and Mr. Buthelezi's removal, as there was no basis and justification for it. Shortly after this meeting, Mr. Tony Gupta and Mr. Duduzani Zuma arrived at my residence. Background to the arrival. Mr. Tony Gupta had called me sometime after I was appointed as the Minister of Transport and asked many questions about PRASA, about the PRASA tender to acquire locomotives, as he had an interest in the tender. I told him that it was my understanding that the tender process had run its course and that it was about to end. He asked more questions in regard to when the tender was advertised, in which print media it was advertised, for how long it had been open for submissions. He further stated that it was his belief and view that the tender process had not been open and transparent, and that he reserved his right to challenge the process in court. My response was that he was within his right to take whatever legal action he felt necessary. I, however, suggested that it might be advisable to first seek clarity to the questions he had posed from the CEO of PRASA, Mr. Lucky Montana, before taking the matter to court. I then organized the meeting and invited him and Lucky Montana to the official residence that was allocated to me as Minister of Transport. I saw nothing untoward in arranging this meeting between Mr. Tony Gupta and Mr. Lucky Montana, as its aim was to clarify and give answers to the questions that Mr. Gupta had posed to me. I did not at any stage ask Mr. Montana to unduly, irregularly, or illegally assist Mr. Gupta. There was no unlawful or malicious intent on my part to facilitating the meeting. I think it is important that at the time the meeting occurred in 2012. I think it is important to remember that at the time the meeting occurred in 2012, the context and public image of members of the Gupta family was not what it is today in 2018. Namely, a family perceived and projected as the personification of corruption incarnate. In 2012, the Gupta brothers were not persona non grata as they are projected to be today. All I knew then was that they were an Indian family originally from India who owned a medium-sized BEE company of moderate means named Sahara, and that they were trying to expand their business interests beyond the confines of the computer market into other business sectors. The objective conditions and the context under which the meeting occurred were thus different to those of today. Then, in 2012, the Gupta family had a medium-sized business of moderate means, unlike today in 2018, when they are perceived to be billionaires. It has to be noted that the meeting with Mr. Montana did not result in Tony Gupta obtaining the locomotive's tender. The 2012 context and the current 2018 context were thus different. During my tenure in the departments of transport and energy, it was not out of the ordinary for the ministry and the department to receive many queries relating to tenders, contracts, customer complaints, and various stakeholder issues relating to the 12 state-owned enterprises that fell under the remit of the Department of Transport and the 8 state-owned enterprises that fell under the Department of Energy. This also applies to state-owned enterprises that fall under the mandate of the Department of Public Enterprises. Ministers and deputy ministers, when possible, give an audience to stakeholders through formal and informal engagement. On that basis, I did meet with stakeholders, interest groups, entities, including ordinary members of the public in the course of my responsibilities. As a matter of course, most meetings took place at the office. However, some meetings took place outside of the office. At the end of the meeting, Mr. Tony Gupta was advised about the advanced stage of the tender process and that it cannot be reversed. In conclusion, Mr. Tony Gupta indicated that he would consider his option of taking the tender process on review. That brought the discussion to an end. A general point worth stating in regard to any meeting is that the intent of the meeting and the outcome of the meeting are important. I have not presided over any meeting where the intent was corrupt and the outcome was the commission of a crime, whether directly or indirectly. I have not abdicated any of my executive functions to any individual, interest group, or entity. In September 2012, Mr. Montana traveled to Germany to attend an Inno Trans-Rail Roadshow. I received a call from Mr. Montana requesting a meeting. He advised me that he was shocked as he had learned that the Gupta brothers told the rolling stock manufacturers that they work for President Zuma, myself, and himself. Upon his return from Germany, such a meeting took place. In all fairness and sincerity, I do not remember each and every detail of the discussions, but I do remember in particular Mr. Montana raising the matter of misrepresentation sharply, and that I also sternly rebuked Mr. Tony Gupta for abusing the name of the president, myself, and that of Mr. Montana. The meeting ended acrimoniously. Sometime after the second meeting, I recall receiving a letter from PRASA addressing the concerns of the chairperson and CEO that there were talks and rumors of imminent changes to the board and that the chairperson and CEO will be removed. In the letter, PRASA alluded to, amongst others, that the suggested restructuring of the board will destabilize the turnaround and modernization initiatives, including uncertainty at PRASA, and that at a critical moment, that would affect the integrity of the procurement process that was underway. I then gave the chairperson and CEO written and verbal assurance that I will not change the PRASA board, including the chairperson and CEO, without legitimate and valid reasons. Indeed, the chairperson, CEO, and board members were not removed. Another time I interacted with Mr. Tony Gupta was during May 2013, whilst I was still the Minister of Transport. Mr. Gupta called me and asked me if it will be possible for a plane conveying their wedding guests to land at OR Tambo International and for the welcoming reception to be held there. I declined this request, and as is common knowledge, the plane thereafter landed at Waterkloof Air Base, which was not in the remit of the authority of the Department of Transport. On the 9th June 2013, I was deployed from the Department of Transport to the Department of Energy. Procedural justice is the thread that weaves the fabric of justice in society. Procedural justice is thus concerned with making and implementing decisions according to fair process. It is my belief that no one should be allowed to use the parliamentary inquiry as a platform to settle personal vendettas or as a vehicle for organized character assassination. If there is anyone who has proof of me having been party to corruption or of me having been party to the commission of a crime, they have a moral and civil duty to report me to the police or any other relevant law enforcement authority. A fundamental principle of South African law is that everyone is presumed innocent until proven guilty. The spirit and letter of that principle is not that an individual is assumed guilty until he or she can prove themselves innocent. Another fundamental principle of our law is that he or she who alleges must prove. No one has the monopoly on truth. Each word has an echo, and so does each silence. I've been perplexed and astounded by the false testimony of Ms. S. Daniels, more so as to why she has not responded, reported the alleged meeting of the 29th July 2017, which, amongst other things, according to her testimony, brought the Deputy Judge President's office into disrepute by insinuating that it was malleable to corruption. I would have thought that, as a member of the legal profession, she would have reported the matter to the South African Police Services and the Law Society of South Africa, of which she is a member. I would not be part of any process, procedure, meeting, and discussion intended to undermine the integrity of the office of the Deputy Judge President. Finally, I repeat that if there is anyone who has evidence of criminality on my part, they should report it to the relevant authorities. Honorable members, I thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Deputy Minister, for the statement you read in front of us. I would now give over to the evidence leader to take the process forward. Evidence leader, Advocate Vanara.
Thanks, Chair. Good morning to yourself, the Deputy Minister.
Morning, Advocate.
Members of the committee, the guests and colleagues. Deputy Minister, I just want us to quickly go back to your letter of the 5th of December 2017. I just want us to clear some of these administrative issues. In the response...
I must just say, Advocate, I don't have the letter in front of me, so I would depend on your engagement of the contents of the said letter.
This is a letter that you addressed to the chair of the committee, Ms. Lungi Mnganga Qabashe. Is that the document?
Is that the letter? Is it the letter...
Dated the 5th of December.
Oh, that's fine.
In a letter that was dated the 30th of November, to which you are responding in this letter, you acknowledge having been furnished with a legal opinion. And you say you had not at the time managed to obtain advice on the opinion. Can you see that it is on the third paragraph, where you say, I have not had an opportunity to seek legal advice on the legal opinion you provided?
That's correct.
I just want to find out if you have, subsequent to this letter, obtained legal advice on the advice that the committee received from Advocate Vamchengov, SC.
legal opinion of Advocate Tengroof, senior counsel to my right, made mention to it, spoke to it about it to me.
And is there convergence on the opinion, or is there a difference of opinion to that of Advocate Tengroof?
From what I recall, senior counsel Libala next to me said that there are portions of the legal opinion of Advocate Tengroof that he agrees with, but there are other matters of law in that opinion that he has a different opinion with regard to what's written there.
The issue around administrative justice applicability to this process, what is the convergence or disagreement around that? You can consult senior counsel just to refresh your memory around that issue, sir.
Senior counsel says that there are aspects of the legal opinion that he differed with. I would request through you, Chairperson, that he articulates what the differences were. He knows them better because he's the one who told me what the differences that he had with the other advocate, Tengroof. That will make it easier.
Was senior counsel's opinion in writing, or is it as a verbal advisor?
It was both. He did furnish a copy in writing, and he spoke to aspects of it.
No, it's fine. All I just wanted was, perhaps the senior counsel is here, just to speak on the issue of the applicability of the administrative justice principles to this kind of an inquiry. That's all that I just want a view from senior counsel.
Senior counsel to respond.
Thank you, members of this important August Forum of our Democracy. Certainly, an opinion of senior counsel remains an opinion. My colleague, Vin Tengroof, SC, esteemed is a senior counsel. I'm a senior counsel. My clients were advised of the differences in the interpretation of procedural fairness. To summarize it and assist this forum, the interpretation of the principles of procedural fairness are not unique to this important forum. This important forum does not have its own unique principles that govern procedural fairness. What has always bewailed the ministry, and in particular Minister Lynn Brown and the Deputy Minister, has been how the processes, in particular of implicated persons, in as far as this forum is concerned, was handled. Let me give an example. Implicated persons' versions were not put before witnesses. Throughout my sitting in instances where I attended this important forum, I've never heard the evidence leader saying to one of the witnesses, "You are implicating Deputy Minister Ben Martens." I had a duty to go and consult Deputy Minister Ben Martens after speaking with you, because this process limits cross-examination. be informed that during my consultation with you, when you're implicating Deputy Minister Ben Martens, and or when you're implicating Minister Lynn Brown, I had a duty to go and consult with them and tell them how you're implicating them. I also had a duty in this forum to put their versions to you as the implicating witnesses. That's a typical example that now, fundamentally, that's one of the most bewailing concerns that my opinion had to deal with. And my interpretation of what fairness entails in that regard differed completely from that of my colleague, esteemed Trengrove SC. To summarize it, Advocate Vanara, my opinion says you had an obligation together with members of this forum when you consult with a witness so that you should avoid one version. Now, the standards and the principles of administrative justice and fair administrative processes and procedures called upon you when you consult with a witness to say you are implicating Lebala. Let me give a hypothesis. The processes of this forum do not accept Lebala to cross-examine. I have a duty to put a version of Lebala so that one version should not be heard. And that's a basis upon which I differed with the conclusion of Trengrove SC. And that's what I've been advising the minister and the deputy minister from the onset. That let your versions or the versions of any witness also be put. And that's where, in my view, and remember, that's my view as senior counsel, Trengrove SC is entitled to his own opinion. I'm entitled to my own opinion. And in conclusion, I say, respectably before this forum, that I think the standards of fairness fell short, in line with that important fundamental premise of our democracy that says administrative fair procedures cannot be lowered.
Thanks, Council. And as you have said, it's a matter of two different opinions provided to different set of clients, and the clients acting in accordance with the advices from their lawyers.
Advocate Barana, with respect, may I close?
With your respect, Advocate, Senior Counsel Lebala, we give people time to respond to any question, and you give your, and those people give other people also time to respond. You are getting into Mr. Advocate Vanara's mouth. You should give him a chance to speak. And then, if he still wants you back, because we are not here for you, we are here for Deputy Minister. In fact, this is just a fair process that you are given to respond to what Advocate Vanara is saying on administrative issues, on legal administrative issues. So you are not here to interrogate anyone. Thank you very much. Advocate Vanara, over to you.
That is fine. Then back to the Minister. Thanks for the clarity. In the initial submission, I think it's part and parcel of the back, Deputy Minister, that you've been given. Must be the second document, which is your submission that you made in December together with the letter. You made reference to three set of letters. The one was the 9th of August, which the minister requested clarity on issues around procedural fairness to the committee. Can you see that? It's the second page of your submission.
I can see that 1.2.
1.1. Yes, 1.2. Yes, you're correct, Deputy Minister. You seem to take an issue that this letter was not responded to at the time. Was the Deputy Minister aware that during this period after the committee had taken a decision to institute the inquiry, that it struggled to get technical support in implementing its decision quietly.
I was not aware of that.
Notwithstanding the fact that the PLO and other officials of the department were in attendance of the committee meetings.
I was not aware of the challenges that you had as organizing one with organizing responsibility. I was not privy to that information.
Further, that the issues raised in that letter, at least is the Deputy Minister prepared to concede that these were legal matters in nature that required the committee to be advised legally.
Yes.
So the Timia's response to the letter, if you were to be told that these were as a result of the lack of technical support to the committee at the time, would the minister, the deputy minister's stance change to from the initial position of saying, look, you were, these letters were not responded timely?
That would be a reasonable response. The other issue that we should also take cognizance here of advocate is that the letter was written to your office by the minister, and the response thereto was expected by the minister. And the information that I had was that letter had been sent, there had been no response to it. And from the side of the minister, I got no further information whether there was a response or not, nor did she intimate to me that she was aware of the challenges that you had. So as I said, with the background that you have given, if a response of this nature was given, it would be appropriate for any reasonable person to understand why there wasn't a letter as forthcoming as soon as possible to explain what the challenges were.
Then there was a second letter. I see you referring to it in paragraph 1.3 as the 16th of October. I assume that you're referring to the letter that is dated the 13th, which got to Parliament on the 17th, to which there was a response which you refer to in 1.4, page 3 of your submission, dated the 20th of October 2017. In other words, the second letter was responded to.
Yeah.
Then I want us to go to paragraph 1.9, page 4 of your submission, Deputy Minister, where you say in the Portfolio Committee's response to the Minister's letter, the committee indicated that in the event that a witness implicates an individual, that individual will be notified and may attend the proceedings. I was not informed that Ms. Daniels will implicate me and was not requested to attend the proceedings. And this is an issue that senior counselors has taken. But before you before we can deal with this, there is a tweet that was attributed to you, Deputy Minister. I just want to read it, just to confirm whether it was indeed your tweet. And this was on the 9th of November, 2017. This is after Ms. Suzanne Daniels would have testified. And it reads as follows. It appears to be Dikobe Ben Martins at Dikobe BM, where the tweet reads as follows. There are many ways to kill a man. The only ammunition you need for character assassination is to allege a phantom meeting with a Gupta without any shred of proof, and then drown what's left of your conscience with a glass of whiskey. Can this tweet be attributed to you, Deputy Minister?
My tweets, if you tweet something, it remains as a record. So I'll have to check the record of my tweets for the 9th of, the 9th of November. Offhand, it sounds like something I might have written, but I would have to check the veracity of the framing of the wording there.
That's right. When you come to the conclusion that Ms. Daniels' testimony implicates you, is it because of legal advice that you sought, or is it a conclusion that you came to on your own?
If I understand what you are saying, did I come to the conclusion that she implicates me as a result of my assessment or the result of legal opinion that I received? My response is that on the basis of her testimony, placing me in a meeting I was not, that implicates me in some form of activity to which I was not party to. That's my assessment.
Okay. So you had not sought legal advice on this matter? You, on your own, assessed the situation and decided that this was implicating you.
From the information in front of me, this is the conclusion that I came to. Why would somebody place me in a meeting I was not? What's the motive of this?
In your understanding, what is it that you were implicated in? Was it just a mere presence in what you term a meeting?
My understanding, my recollection of the testimony that was given to the portfolio committee is that there was a meeting, and at the meeting, Brian Molefe's matter was discussed. And at that same meeting, the issue of the Deputy Judge President's office was discussed as to how the date could be postponed to a later period or after a certain period. So all that, it's my view that it placed me in a context I would not be, where you discuss how to undermine the office of the Deputy Chief Judge President.
This was Ms. Suzanne's testimony before the committee, specifically around reference to your name, that she had received a telephone call from Mr. Salim Essa, inviting her to Melrose Park to have a cup of tea together. And that when she got to Melrose Park, she was then taken to a flat in Melrose Park, wherein yourself, say Mr. Gupta, were in the flat. That Mr. Gupta then started asking her about the status of Mr. Brian Molefe's matter and when that case would be heard. And at the meeting, you didn't say anything. The sense that I at least got of the meeting was that this was not a meeting with an agenda to discuss a Mr. Brian Molefe's pending case in court which was to be heard, but rather you found yourself in a room where somebody had raised an issue with her. So there was no reference to you. There was no reference to you having been part of a meeting and contributing to the discussions, nor having demonstrated any knowledge of a prior discussion on this matter. Now this is where I must be upfront with you, Honorable Deputy Minister. At that stage, I as evidence leader did not see any evidence implicating you in any wrongdoing. Now, this is what I want to understand. What is it that you found so implicating in wrongdoing that could be attributed to yourself?
My response was just that, how does somebody place me in a meeting that I was not? Simple. And I couldn't understand this. Why should I be placed in a meeting? Somebody leads evidence here. And my rationalization of this afterwards was the response. This is why my response was what it was. Why am I placed in this context of this meeting? The response immediately was that Martens is in a Gupta meeting and what have you. Because as I said in my earlier statement, 2012, 4 years or what have you, it was a different dispensation. Right now, members of that particular family are regarded as corruption personified. So the next day that I went to address a press conference there, I was asked, why were you there in that meeting? It was not your innocent interpretation of somebody just being found there, you see. The association was that there must have been something wrong that was being done there.
So if I understand you correctly, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that it was the mere association with the Gupta family that drew you to conclude that you were implicated in some form of wrongdoing?
As I said earlier, first and foremost, why locate me in a meeting that I was not? And I don't know what's being discussed there. And then members of the Gupta family are mentioned there. And in the current environment, so that raised questions in my mind.
So that will be consistent And I do concede that you still to verify the wording of your tweet. Where you say there are many ways to kill a man, and the only ammunition you need for character assassination is to allege a phantom meeting with a Gupta. From this, I read again that in your view, in this toxic environment, an association to the Guptas is something bad, and that you need to distance yourself, particularly when you are of the view that it didn't happen.
As I say, I don't have the wording of the tweet in front of me. But what I can say to you, there are two poetry books that I wrote. Baptism of Fire, before I went to Robben Island in 1983, and Prison Poems. I think in Baptism of Fire, there's a poem that I wrote there, that there are many ways to kill a man. And that was referring to interrogation, torture, discrediting. So the context there, as I say, I can't, without the wording of the tweet that you referred to, and with authenticity of that tweet, if it's my tweet and if I had written it, but the association I can see. So the wording there and the context would be from that poem there, that there are indeed many ways to kill a man.
The tweets are in cell phones, correct, Deputy Minister?
Yes.
Do you still have your phone?
I still have my phone.
Is it difficult to check this tweet?
I've checked it.
Okay, can you check it, Deputy Minister, so that we clarify this thing once and for all?
I don't have the phone in with me. It's with VIP Protection Services. Before I came to the meeting, I handed over my two phones to them.
Okay. You have given in both your submission that we're going through on page 6, the steps of what you did on the day. It is alleged that you were at this meeting. From 3.8, I think 3.14. And today you've also indicated that the people that you were at, the ANC Lehutla and the dinner, are prepared to testify to that effect. But is the Deputy Minister prepared to concede that the individuals mentioned, specifically in paragraph 3.14, cannot attest of the Deputy Minister's movements after he left the ANC Lehutla that evening?
As I said in my statement, I left at approximately 8:30 and in the company of the IP protection unit, and they took me to my residence. So the people I mentioned here, it states there that they can attest for the time I spent with them at the ANC Lehutla.
The question is, Deputy Minister, they will end there.
Yes.
They'll say, you were here with us, we saw you. But they can't say what the Deputy Minister did after leaving the meeting, after leaving the ANC Lehutla, is that correct? Let's get to your meeting with Mr. Multana. Lucky Montana. You issued a statement, and apparently in your statement, and this is one of the reasons that Mr. Montana came to testify on yesterday, where you implied or insinuated that it was Mr. Montana who introduced the Gupta brother to you. And Mr. Montana's version is that it is the other way around. And you seem to be confirming that today, that at the meeting that took place at your residence, Mr. Montana got the first, and that the two gentlemen joined the meeting. Is that correct, sir?
What I would like to correct is that the day after Ms. Daniels gave a testimony, I had a press briefing. And at the press briefing, I said specifically in reply to a question that was asked as to, have you had meetings with the Guptas? And I mentioned about three or four different occasions I had interaction with the Guptas. And one of those interactions that I mentioned, I said that there's a meeting that I organized in order to discuss issues pertinent to Prasa. Mr. Montana, I'm not sure if he saw that himself or he heard from somebody else about that briefing, got the impression that I had said that he brought the Guptas to me, which was never the case. It has never been said by myself. If there's a clip of that particular engagement, it will show me saying that I organized that particular meeting.
The different engagements, the Deputy Minister, between yourself and the Gupta brother or brothers, including Mr. Duduzane Zuma in certain instances. And let me be specific. When one of the Gupta brothers called you in connection with the landing of the plane at Waterkloof Base, I don't know, maybe I'm being misled by the sequencing of the events in your submission, but it appears to be long after interactions with Mr. Montana, is that correct?
It appears to be?
To be long after interactions that you, Mr. Montana, and the Gupta brothers would have had around Prasa issues. Is that the correct understanding?
Yeah, it seems so. I would have to check the dates, but it does seem to be an event after that engagement with Mr. Lucky Montana.
And you do recall that when Mr. Montana came from Berlin, there's no factual dispute, at least around that, he came back, Mr. Montana, that is, furious about what he had learned in Berlin at the meeting, to which you also confirm. And in your testimony, you even rebuked Mr. Tony Gupta. Did you receive any complaints from a person or one of the Gupta brothers about Mr. Montana refusing to allow Salim Essa and Mr. Akbal to serve in the evaluation panel of this role, this tender that you had had discussions on?
No, I do not recall that. Because what I recall, shortly when I became Minister of Transport, the issue pertaining to the rolling stock acquisition for PRASA, I had been given a report by officials at PRASA that the process had almost run its course and was at an end. And I was also informed that the committee that was in charge of overseeing the tender process was a committee that the board of PRASA, CEO, there had been a process, and independent people were responsible for that tender process, and they were in lockdown. There's a particular venue that they were, where they were not in access with anybody, a secured venue. So that was the information that I had. And I could not see how anybody else would be parachuted into that process at a late stage.
Well, when did you learn about that? Is it before you called Mr. Montana to your residence, where you were later joined by Mr. Tony Gupta and Mr. Duduzane Zuma?
No, the information as to what happens at various entities. As soon as I became a minister, I was given reports as to what's happening into the different areas shortly after my appointment.
So that would have been even before your meeting with Mr.
Yes.
Then if the process, you knew that this process was at this advanced stage, and you were approached by Mr. Tony Gupta with Mr. Duduzane Zuma about the process, why didn't you just give them the briefing that you had received when you assumed office? Why was it necessary for you, Deputy Minister, to call Mr. Montana to that meeting?
In my interaction with them, I told them that the information that I have is that the tender process was open, stakeholders, any interested party were entitled to engage in that process. So if they had not done so, that was their fault. Then he mentions the issues that I elaborate here in my statement. What was the duration of this process? Was it open and fair? Where was it advertised? A number of technical specific questions that I did not have the information to. And then somewhere along the line that he says that I will take this matter to court and what have you. And I say that there's somebody who can give you information in regard to the course that this process has run. To obviate you taking the department to court, then I organized this meeting with Mr. Montana for him solely to explain to them where that process was. And that was the remit and extent of that meeting. And he did so at that meeting.
Was there any prior engagement between yourself and the two gentlemen that were in the meeting about Mr. Lucky Montana's suitability for his position as the CEO at PRASA?
No, there was no prior engagement with them in regard to Mr. Montana's position. As I was appointed Minister of Transport, Mr. Montana was the CEO, Mr. Buthelezi was the chairperson, and there were board members there. And in that context, I learned of from Mr. Montana and Mr. Buthelezi that there was word going around, there were rumors going around that the two of them would be removed from PRASA. And I said to them verbally, to Mr. Buthelezi and Mr. Montana, that I would not allow any situation where anybody can influence me and Julie or anybody in the department to have them removed without justified reason. And I even went further to say to them that if that had to be, that had to happen, then I also had would fall with them, be removed with them.
Mr. Montana testified yesterday, and it is in his submission that, and in his submission that will be page 55, where he says that, and I quote him verbatim, they, in other words, Mr. Gupta and Mr. Duduzane Zuma, were arrogant and reminded Ben Martins that they did not want me, and he had convinced them that I was his comrade. Do you remember such a discussion?
I don't remember such a discussion.
Did such a discussion take place?
I said I don't remember such a discussion in my presence. So in my presence, it did not take place.
Did it take place in the presence of yourself, Mr. Tony Gupta, and Mr. Duduzane Zuma?
I thought this is what I just answered now, that such a discussion did not take place in my presence, that they had to be removed.
You are aware that in your submission you're not dealing with this particular issue that you're disputing now. The refreshed, the latest of
yes.
The, why not?
The reason I've not gone through Mr. Montana's statement. He gave his version of events yesterday until the commission started shortly before he gave his evidence. I had not received his testimony, and I didn't watch his testimony over TV. So after he gave his testimony, all I had to do is prepare my input basically myself.
So your senior
counsel... I've not gone through his testimony that he gave. I saw a thick tome.
So the senior counsel that was here yesterday and your head of legal were given the submission, did not bring this important thing to your attention. Is that what you're saying?
No, no. I'm saying that at what time, I don't know at what time they were given. All I've said to you was that at the time Mr. Montana spoke, before 2 o'clock, I'm not sure what time he spoke, I only had sight of the submission that Mr. Montana made was after senior counsel and the other advocate came back from the proceedings, and that was already late at night. So this particular portion that you referred to, I have not seen it.
I accept that you didn't see it, but they did not bring it to your attention. Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't remember them bringing it to my attention.
In your assessment of the conduct of these two gentlemen, Mr. Duduzane Zuma and Mr. Atul Gupta, did you at any stage find their behavior problematic?
In my interactions with Mr. Tony Gupta, I've seen an avid businessman who's looking for avenues to find ways of making money or strengthening his company.
In other words, you've not seen any wrongdoing in him?
No, I've seen that he's a person who, as I said in my submission, the first time I got into contact with them when they were running Sahara, and what I'd read about South African Sahara was that it was a medium-sized company struggling to grow. And on the various occasions, this is why I say that my impression, what I see, has been somebody like any other businessman who's looking for opportunities to empower or enrich themselves or their company.
Not even after Mr. Montana came back from Berlin and told them in front of you what they were doing in the name of the president?
That one I covered. My recollection was that Mr. Montana had given me a report on this, and then when we met him, we told him exactly what we felt about what Lucky says they allegedly did outside the country.
You said you rebuked them, that's
yes.
The words in a statement.
Yes.
Did you rebuke them for doing the right thing, or did you rebuke them for doing the wrong thing?
I've never come across somebody who rebukes anyone for doing the right thing. So when I rebuked them, was on the basis of the information that Mr. Montana had given, that there was misrepresentation, and that can't be correct, even if a person is an avid business person to enhance their company, but you can't enhance it with misrepresentation. And utilizing the names of the office of the president, a minister, and a CEO in a company.
So at least for the record, that was the first instance that you saw there was something wrong here, correct?
Yes. That was the first instance that I had not proof, but I had to work on the basis of trust. What I heard from Lucky, the report that he gave me.
When they called you, when Mr. Tony Gupta called you for permission to land at Waterkloof, was that the right thing for him to have done?
I would like to correct that portion. Mr. Tony Gupta never called me for permission to land at Waterkloof. Waterkloof Air Base falls under the Department of Defense. It does not fall under the Department of Transport. So when he called me and asked if the plane could land at OR Tambo International, the size of the plane is like any other planes. I don't recall the exact, is it a 727 or whatever, of the plane. The issue in question there is that many planes from different countries, since to be specific, a plane would come from India. It would have to land like any other plane. But the permission sought here was that when our plane lands at OR Tambo, is it possible that where the plane has landed, that there can be a welcoming ceremony there? As our guests get out of the plane, they can be received. And my response was that it can happen for a few reasons. And I articulated the reasons as such. Any plane that lands there, as people get out of the plane, you can't have song and dance in front of the plane as people get out. And where people get out of the plane and where they go to stamp their passports, that falls under the remit of Home Affairs. It's not transport. So it's only after you have stamped your passport and you go through and you go to fetch your luggage. From there onwards is where the jurisdiction of transport is. So I explained all these things as to why it could not happen there. And I suggested that, in my knowledge, I know there's an airport closer to Sun City where the wedding was scheduled to take place. And I said, I've never been to Bilansburg Airport. But what I was informed, it was a smaller airport like an aerodrome. They might be able to accommodate a plane landing depending on its size and organize the reception area. But I said that it can't happen at O.R. Tambo Airport.
Let me acknowledge that I made a mistake. In your submission, it is O.R. Tambo. It is not the Glove Base. In your tenure as the Minister of Transport, have you ever received such a request?
No, I have not.
If you ask Mr. Gupta, what was the basis of him making such a request to you about the landing or about the dents around the airport?
He said that the guests, that would be a good way of welcoming his guests if there's this ceremony there. And I said that unfortunately that cannot happen, it's not regular.
Was it not because he considered you a friend that he would ask a favor from a friend?
Mr. Gupta has never been my friend. Within the remit of my various responsibilities as Minister of Transport, before that as Deputy Minister of Public Enterprises and Minister of Energy, you meet many individuals from different stations of life, and you interact with them as far as work is concerned. If they make requests, where it is reasonable, where it's possible, you can do so. But under no circumstance can I say that Mr. Tony Gupta is a friend of mine. He's not a friend of mine.
Was it because of a relationship? It might not have been a friendship. It might have been because, as you say, you meet a number of business people, they express interest in this or that. Well, was it because of that that he would have had courage? As you say, nobody has ever made such a request in your tenure as a deputy, as a Minister of Transport.
I'm not sure if it's a question of courage or somebody looking after their own interests, saying that, what can I do? People always push, for want of a better conceptualization, they push the envelope in their own interest.
The PRASA AGM that was postponed, you were still the Minister of Transport. Mr. Montana testified yesterday, and it is also in his submission, that an Indian chap had earlier referred or indicated to him that the AGM would be postponed, and that indeed the AGM was later postponed in 2012. Why was the AGM postponed?
I would have to check as to why the AGM was postponed. Preparations for AGMs involves the office of the minister, it involves the office of the DG, it involves the board of an entity, it involves the CEO chairperson there. So there are multiplicity of factors that can result in the AGM taking place on time or not. So in this particular instance, I don't want to just guess and say for this reason the AGM was cancelled. I would have to canvass and find out from that particular period as to why that particular AGM did not take place at the first appointed date.
One last question from the Deputy Minister. Is you are aware that your committee was looking at certain governance lapses within ESCOM?
Which committee?
This
when
committee.
You say my committee?
This committee.
Okay.
You are aware of that?
Yes, that's the remit of one of the aims and objectives of this inquiry.
And that there has been testimony that has been adduced before the committee, including that of Suzanne Daniels, to which you've responded. And in your December submission, you don't deal with the issues surrounding Mr. Tony Gupta and Duduzane Zuma. You only deal with that in your later submission, after Mr. Montana has made a submission and gave testimony yesterday. Is that correct?
That's correct. Then we should also look at the correspondence that I have received as the Deputy Minister. If I recall, Advocate, the first invitation was to deal with the governance at ESCOM. But the manner in which the letter was framed, my rejoinder response thereto was that in terms of delegations of responsibility, that is directly the purview of the minister. Subsequent to that, there was another letter that I received. And then I think that particular letter said, deal with the testimony of Ms. Suzanne Daniels. Then subsequent to that, a third letter was received. This was the letter of the 26th of this month, saying that Suzanne Daniels' matter, yes, but also be aware that the issue, Mr. Montana, in his testimony, might, what's the word, implicate you or, yeah. So in that context, then, I did not know what was the remit of Mr. Montana's evidence, if there's something that I had to engage or respond to. I could only do that late last night after the good advocate and the other advocate came back from this engagement to say that this is what transpired. These are some of the elements there. So on that basis, I responded to one or two of the issues. I could not have done so if that was not the guidance that I received from the committee. If we recall in my letter or where I started, I thanked the chairperson of the committee for the guidance given to me, saying that the issue of Ms. Zan Daniels will be canvassed and the issues raised by Mr. Montana. Thus, I responded to some of the meetings and the issues to put them in context as far as I remember.
So before Mr. Lucky Montana came forward, the Deputy Minister didn't deem it necessary to take the committee into confidence. Yes, disputing that you were at the meeting as alleged by Suzanne Daniels, but also saying, look, the only instances, as you've done now, that I met these individuals were these different instances. That's all that I want to find out. You didn't deem it necessary.
No. I think we should put things into context. You have just said that I did not deem it necessary to take the committee into confidence in regard to engagements with the Guptas. Am I misunderstanding you?
No, I'm asking. I'm just asking, did you not deem it necessary? I'm not saying you deemed it necessary.
Yes. What I've said that even in public, immediately after Ms. Suzanne Daniels made an input here, I spoke in a public forum where I addressed a press conference about different instances where I'd met the Gupta, members of the Gupta family. So it's not a question that if I had not mentioned it in a previous conversation, I would not have mentioned it. I had no problem with mentioning that. This is why at the press conference I gave instances that led to the misunderstanding that Mr. Montana had, that I had said he had brought Tony Gupta to me.
No further questions, Chair.
Thank you, Advocate Vanara. I am now going to give over to members to ask questions. But I just want to put it on record, members, honorable members, that we are not a court of law. The approach that we took as this committee is to listen to everybody whom we think will give us a clear picture of what is happening in Eskom. We are not putting people on a stand here in saying you are an accused and you are a witness that is going to give evidence against the accused. So I just wanted to clarify, our approach is to get information from those people implicated and from people who think they have information that can help the committee to either clarify the implicated people or to further give evidence against the implicated people. That's the intention of the committee. We are not a court of law and we will never be a court of law. Our approaches will not be the same as a court of law. I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you very much, honorable members, Kungubele, honorable Mazoni, honorable Swart, honorable Ganga Gabashe, honorable Zamini, honorable Luyenge. In that order, Kungubele, time 10 minutes each. Endless. Yes. Thank you very much, Honorable Kungubele.
Uh,